Donald Trump refuses to rule out an independent White House bid and leaves his rivals struggling for attention during a feisty first Republican presidential debate. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll get debate analysis and comments on some other political news from Dennis Goldford at Drake University to start our program. Also, how could it happen? A meth lab in a Cedar Rapids Taco Bell. Iowa State University wins its first Formula Sun Grand Prix for solar cars. How Iowa's drug courts make a difference. And Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register previews this year's Iowa State Fair. This hour's News Buzz served up on a stick. After this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donald Trump refused to rule out an independent White House bid, leaving his rivals struggling for attention last night during a feisty first Republican presidential debate. Joining me now with some analysis, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and the Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
This debate involved 10 candidates, all very much revolving around the leader in the polls, Donald Trump, it seemed, and his unorthodox approach to campaigning. The billionaire developer made some controversial statements about undocumented immigration during the debate, a signature issue of his campaign.
People that I deal with, that I talk to, they say this is what's happening because our leaders are stupid. Our politicians are stupid. And the Mexican government is much smarter, much sharper, much more cunning. And they send the bad ones over because they don't want to pay for them. They don't want to take care of them. Why should they when the stupid leaders of the United States will do it for them? And that's what's happening, whether you like it or not.
Dennis Goldford, how did Donald Trump fare in your estimation?
Well, I don't know that he disappointed the people he's attracted so far, because as we've talked about on Politics Wednesday, I think he represents people, or he's appointed himself tribune of people who are disgusted by politics and politicians as usual. But he's made his basic threat that was always there to the Republican Party that he might not support the eventual nominee if that's not Donald Trump. And he was his usual sort of bombastic, self-regarding, uncontrolled or undisciplined speaker. I haven't heard the word stupid used so many times since I last passed by a grade school playground.
Now, he was asked by Fox News moderators about his previous political positions, which in some cases were 180 degrees from conservative positions are generally thought to be. He seemed to just shrug it off. There was no, he wasn't going to take the flip-flop label or whatever label you want to give him.
Trump's really about anger. I mean, and Kasich and others pointed that out, the governor of Ohio, who I think did himself some good last night. He's tapped into something, and there is an anger on the part of people, as I said, who are just fed up with normal politics and politicians. They just think things are getting out of control and nobody's handling them from either party. But there's more of that because of suspicion of government on the Republican side. And I think that in that sense, while he talks about being opposed to illegal immigration, when he said to Chris Wallace, you never knew about this till I announced, well, that's nonsense. He must not have heard of Steve King, who's been riding that horse for a long time. It's simply a kind of standing in a room somewhere and screaming a rage. I think that's what Trump at this point does for a lot of people.
Aside from Trump, Governor Chris Christie and Senator Rand Paul got into a dust-up over NSA surveillance after Paul told Christie, I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from innocent Americans.
That's a completely ridiculous answer. I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from other people. How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed
to?
No, I'll tell you how you
get a warrant.
Let me tell you something.
Get a judge to sign
when you, you know, Senator.
Go ahead, wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator, you know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that
Here's
you use the
problem,
system
Governor.
The way it's supposed
Here's
to work.
Here's the problem, Governor. You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights. Every time you did a case, you got a warrant from a judge. I'm talking about searches without warrants, indiscriminately of all Americans' records, and that's what I fought to end. I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug, and if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
And
go ahead, Governor.
And you know, Senator Paul, you know, the hugs that I remember are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th. Those are the hugs I remember. And those had nothing to do with politics. Unlike what you're doing by cutting speeches on the floor of the Senate, then putting them on the internet within a half an hour to raise money for your campaign,
all right,
and while still putting our country at risk.
All right, we're going to cut it off there. We have plenty more we want to get to.
Okay, speaking of that playground fight that you mentioned earlier on, Dennis Goldberg, perhaps a good example right there.
Well, I think that Chris Christie's trying to show that he remains relevant, and his relevance is that he is a non-genial, non-conventional, he considers himself a non-genial, non-typical politician type, whereas Ben Carson is a genial non-politician type. But he picked an easy target with Rand Paul because what we're hearing from Paul, in a way, is the sound or the sight of him waving goodbye as his campaign fades back over the horizon. Paul's been struggling quite a bit lately, but at the same time, the two of them represent a legitimate issue for Americans. We want security and we want freedom. And if they conflict with each other, how do we find the balance? Their screaming didn't do it justice, but they do represent a legitimate concern.
Mm-hmm. Could it also be said that one clear winner of the debates last night was Fox News, the moderator setting the tone and themes of the debate? Would you say were tough questions on a conservative agenda?
They were pretty good questions. I mean, a couple of them were sort of silly, I think, but they honed in on particular areas of interest or vulnerability on the part of the candidates. One report I read after having endured all 3 hours of these debates myself was that if these questions had been asked by so-called mainstream media, conservatives on Fox would have been yelling that these were slanted and ideologically biased questions. So they did attempt to make the candidates squirm, and I think they were successful in doing that.
Let me talk quickly to get your thoughts on a couple of other political items in our news in the last few days. On Wednesday, two allies of the U.S. Republican presidential contender Rand Paul were charged along with another man with concealing payments made to a local politician secure an endorsement for Paul's father during the 2012 presidential election cycle. Prosecutors say these three men concealed payments to Iowa State Senator Ken Sorensen, to get him to switch his endorsement to Ron Paul. A spokesman for Rand Paul's campaign said in a statement, the timing of the indictment before this Republican debate appears suspiciously timed and possibly politically motivated. Fallout for the Rand Paul campaign, which you mentioned, isn't doing too well lately.
Well, it's not good news for them, but I haven't seen anybody allege that Rand Paul himself was any part of this. This is a lingering issue from the 2012 campaign and the obviously, as you said, the Ron Sorensen switch. And it shows how easily you can get caught up in the intricacies of election law. But at the same time, again, I think there are bigger issues for the Paul campaign than this, even though this is not something that helps them.
Mm-hmm. Iowa House Speaker Craig Paulson, Republican, announced this week he would step down, not seek reelection. Briefly, the significance of this Republican leader stepping down?
Well, to my knowledge at this point, we don't know if there's anything else there. It may be simply that's a tough job and he's tired of doing it. And, of course, you know, we have a part-time legislature that meets roughly 100 days or so every year. And it could well be simply that he wants to move on to other things in his life.
Okay. This week, Jon Stewart, ending his 16-year reign as host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, ending this week much of his satire aimed at the hypocrisy in politics, present in both major political parties. Jon Stewart giving wit to a frustration that many Americans feel about our political system. What can you say at this farewell point to Jon Stewart about his approach to humor and possibly changing the discourse in this country or adding to it in some way?
I think he's added to it to the extent that he gets young people or has been able to get young people to have some sort of interest in politics. Now, what's questionable or worrying is if the Daily Show was their only source of information about politics. But I think The Daily Show under Jon Stewart fits into a long tradition of political satire in America that includes H.L. Mencken and Will Rogers and Mark Twain. And, you know, oftentimes the best way to confront the powerful and the pompous is to deflate them with humor rather than to fight them on particular issues. And that's what The Daily Show seemed to do.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the effect, though, is making the viewers more cynical about American politics. I mean, it uncovered things for many viewers, not that they weren't there before, but opened our eyes to hypocrisy. We had politicians saying in 1 year one thing and then something completely different the next year. That was a standard for Jon Stewart.
Well, I think you're right about that. There is the concern always about cynicism in politics. I'm sometimes asked if my students are cynical about politics, and I've often said they haven't lived long enough to earn the right to be cynical yet. But still, if that's your only source of information, the concern is that you will simply dismiss all this as irrelevant to your life. At the same time, I think there are times when Stewart sort of looked directly at the camera and you saw the real Jon Stewart and the kinds of things that were very personal to him, for example, 9/11 and things like that. And he would show that, yes, some things do matter, even if it's not all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Back to the debate and Donald Trump. What would an independent bid by Donald Trump, and he didn't rule that out last night, the only candidate on stage not to, what would a bid by Donald Trump likely do to the GOP's chances of reclaiming the White House, you think?
The assumption is that he would take votes from a Republican candidate because that segment of the electorate that's so angry with the way things are tends to be the Tea Party kind of segment that Ted Cruz is trying to capture for himself. So he's been pushed somewhat into the background by all of this. The issue, of course, is to remember that we've had third-party candidates before. Now, while Ross Perot in 1992 earned 19% of the vote, he didn't capture a single electoral vote. Did he tip any states toward Bill Clinton instead of President Bush? Republicans like to say he tipped the whole election to Bill Clinton, but most studies suggest that Perot voters would have split pretty evenly between Clinton and Bush if Perot weren't there.
Mm-hmm. Many analysts predicting Donald Trump's lead cannot be sustained, that he can never win the nomination. Are you in that camp?
At the risk of that's inherent in any prediction, I would say that I am.
Okay, that he will flame out, bow out, probably not exit graciously.
We don't have any evidence so far that he would be willing to do that. But the task for Republicans is to try to ease him out with respect. And his threat to run as a third-party candidate, again, there are all sorts of technical complications to make that really difficult. But his threat seems to be that he would do so if he felt disrespected.
Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and the Flansburgh Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Dennis, thanks for your insights.
Anytime, Ben. Take care.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How could it happen? Here's an Iowa news story that was picked up nationally by many news media outlets. On Tuesday, two men were arrested and charged after police found remnants of a methamphetamine lab inside an Iowa Taco Bell, this in Cedar Rapids. Lee Hermiston is with us, reporter for the Gazette based in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on with us. It happened in the wee morning of the hours, the discovery. How?
That's right. Started with a suspicious persons report. They were called to the restaurant and found these two gentlemen that you mentioned outside the restaurant. It was around, I believe, 4 a.m., so definitely no reason for them to be there at the time. Police called the manager, who gave them permission to check out the restaurant, and inside they found the remnants of a meth lab as well as some produced methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm. Two individuals, a 31-year-old and a 56-year-old. Any thought that this goes past those two individuals?
Yeah, it doesn't look like it. That's always a possibility, but anymore, meth doesn't have that big conspiracy that you might associate with drugs such as heroin that are tied to the gangs. A lot of it is these kind of fly-by-night, one-man operations, or in this case, two-man operations. You don't need that big network to sell and distribute. More often than not, and it seems to be the case in this instance, the guy was just cooking his own kind of personal supply.
Mm-hmm. But still, nonetheless, probably cooking meth while they were cooking tacos and burritos.
You know, I couldn't say that for any certainty. My knowledge of cooking meth is a bit limited, but I think that it's entirely feasible that he would have been able to be in there after hours and doing this long after the restaurant had closed. He was, I believe, an assistant manager, so he certainly would have had access to the store and seemed to be doing this after hours. And Taco Bell was quick to point out to us that none of the meth-making materials were found in the kitchen itself. It sounds more like a utility room or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Is this Taco Bell, this one on Blair's Ferry Road northeast in Cedar Rapids, is it open again?
Well, we heard that they were going to try to reopen today, and we've got a reporter checking in on that. We don't know yet. They do have some cleanup to do. As you can imagine, there's some chemicals that you do not want with your chalupas and your whatnot. So they do have to do some cleaning. We were told that they intended to have that done and submit a letter to the proper authorities that the cleaning was complete by today.
Okay. Posing a unique challenge for Iowa's health officials, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. I think this is, for a lot of folks, some kind of new territory for them. You don't hear of meth labs in restaurants very often, if ever.
Lee Hermiston, reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Thanks for keeping us up to date on this story.
You bet.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Iowa State University's team, PRISM, raced its student-made solar car to its first ever victory at the Formula Sun Grand Prix. This happened in Austin, Texas last week. The event is a competition between student organizations in which these large, very large, solar-powered cars try to make as many laps around a 3.4-mile track as possible during 3 days of racing. Team PRISM not only won with a total of 223 laps, it dominated. No other competitor was within 30 laps after 3 days and 24 hours of hot racing in Austin. Matt Good is with us, project director of the PRISM team, an Iowa State University undergrad student. And Matt Good, welcome to the program. You helped design this car?
That is correct.
Congratulations on this honor, first place.
Yeah, it's definitely awesome for the team. We have some pretty big goals going in the next couple of years. So it not only really shows that in the past we've been on track, but it really shows that going forward we're going to have great plans, great designs for the next car.
Okay. Radio makes the best pictures for the mind. So describe the car you built.
Well, a lot of people actually say it looks like a boat, and it looks very interesting from that point. It's very flat, and it's three wheels. Two wheels in the front, one in the rear, and around each wheel we have coverings to deflect the air around the wheels. So it does look kind of boatish to where, you know, it could sail through water, but it's designed this way to deflect the air around and make sure it's very aerodynamic.
Mm-hmm. And it's, is it roughly the size of a regular car?
That is correct. Yep.
Mm-hmm. How much does it weigh?
400 pounds. So pretty light.
400 pounds. Still pretty big. This doesn't include a driver, does it?
That is correct. That is without the driver inside.
Okay, so no cars in this competition. They're all remotely controlled?
Every single one has to have a driver. That's part of the regulations.
Oh, so they are inside?
Yeah, so there is a person that sits inside the car, and it makes it pretty interesting for our drivers because when you're on the track, it's about 130 degrees, 140 degrees inside the car, and we don't have air conditioning because we're trying to cut weight. So your only way of really getting a nice cool breeze is through a little shop vac tube we glue to the inside of the vehicle.
Who is your driver for your team?
We actually have four of them, three freshmen this year and one senior, and they're all members of the team. And as long as you can fit inside the car and be able to jump out of the car in 10 seconds, you're able to run the vehicle.
Okay, so there were pit stops.
That is correct, yep. We actually, it's just like a Formula One race where we have to bring the car in, change tires, change drivers, change their water pack that's inside, and also do fixes on the car.
Mm-hmm. 400 pounds, how much did it cost to build this winning entry?
This car costs $350,000 to build, so it's not a cheap vehicle, and a lot of that's in the material choice we use. We have high-strength carbon fiber, aluminum space frame, and when you start adding all this together, it really kind of starts racking up in price.
Right. Plenty of sun in Austin, Texas, where you ran this race. So this huge solar panel is the only source of power. It converts the solar energy into electricity?
That is correct. We also have a battery pack that's in the front of the car. And before the competition, you're allowed to charge up the batteries by whatever means. But once the competition starts, any energy has to be captured from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So those 223 laps we were able to put on were all powered off of the sun. And last year, this car actually went from Austin, Texas to Minneapolis, Minnesota, all by the sun power.
Mm. Oh, so it's legal to be on interstates with it.
That is correct. Earlier this year, we drove 1,500 miles across the state of Iowa from west to east, covering the state and also showing it off to a lot of students and colleges and also businesses. Overall, we impact probably 50,000 people per year actually showing this vehicle off and showing how renewable energy can be a viable way of transportation in the future.
Mm-hmm. So this car or something like it eventually finding its way to the consumer market?
That's what we hope. The next car we're going to build is actually going to be a two-seater car, and we're hoping to really make it so when we see kids, they come up and say, well, why can't my mom have this yet? We want to kind of instill that into the younger generation so we can build a car, and it might be a little expensive right now, but with any new technology, it's really expensive when you bring it to market. So if we can build a two-seater car now that people want to buy, in 5 years, 10 years, the cost might be low enough to where we actually start production of them.
Mm-hmm. So you'll be entering, you'll be part of the team next year, Matt?
That is correct. I'll be the project director then, and we're hoping to start designs for a car to race in the World Solar Challenge, which takes place in Australia, and the timeline for that's going to be in 2017.
How fast can this car go?
Top speed is about 75 miles an hour.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and cruising speed just off the sun is 45 miles an hour, and we actually use the same amount of energy as an electric hair dryer. So every time you dry your hair in the morning, we're actually using that amount of energy to go down the highway at 45 miles an hour.
Okay. Matt Good, we'll think about our hair dryers differently from now on. Okay. Project director for the PRISM team, an Iowa State University undergrad student. The team PRISM raced its student-made solar car to its first ever victory at the Formula Sun Grand Prix in Austin, Texas last week. Congratulations again, Matt Good.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Coming up in our second half hour, how Iowa's drug courts make a difference. Also, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register will be along. He'll preview this year's Iowa State Fair starting next week. That's after we take a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register will be along to tell us about this year's Iowa State Fair and some of his favorite things. But first, Local and national politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, have called for reforms aimed at reducing America's prison and jail populations, particularly nonviolent offenders such as drug users. And in a speech earlier this month to the NAACP, President Obama said the U.S. needs to fund more drug courts. He says these specialized courts save taxpayer dollars that would otherwise be spent on imprisonment. The drug court model came to Iowa back in 1996, when the first court was set up in Polk County. Then, in 2000, the then-governor, Tom Vilsack, called for more courts to be started across the state, and they were often launched with federal grant money. Since 2001, more than 1,100 offenders have graduated from adult drug courts across Iowa. They've turned out to be very popular among prosecutors, judges, and community leaders. Yet despite this, several Iowa drug courts have experienced some sluggish legislative funding, so much so that they're now in jeopardy. For instance, the drug court in Council Bluffs that takes offenders from 9 southwest Iowa counties is set to close October 1st. And advocates say 2 regional drug courts covering 14 southeast Iowa counties, as well as Burlington and Ottumwa, are also at risk of closing. Joining us now to explain more about the way drug courts work, Rachel Antonuccio is an attorney in the Juvenile Division of the Iowa City Public Defender's Office, also a member of the Johnson County Family Treatment Court team. And Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Explain a little bit more, because unless you've been directly involved with a drug court or have a family member who's been involved here, you might not even know these things exist. What are they? How do they work?
Sure. So in Johnson County, we have 2 sets of drug courts. We have the Family Treatment Court, which is the court I'm affiliated with. And that's a court for parents who have struggles with addiction, who are in danger of losing their children. So they're involved in this court as kind of a last resort in keeping their kids and getting safe and sober so that they can maintain their kids safely in their home. In Johnson County, we also have a drug court, which is a criminal court for folks who are facing prison. Again, people suffering from substance abuse issues, trying to get treatment in lieu of going to prison.
Mm-hmm. You've worked with a number of these people, had contact with a number of people. What can you say in your experience about the impact? Also talking with colleagues about drug courts being on the scene versus not being on the scene.
Sure. So obviously, anecdotally, I've represented a number of folks, both in the Family Treatment Court and then representing folks in juvenile court who are also affiliated with the criminal drug court. So I feel I have a pretty good sense of how it impacts folks' lives. I have been amazed by many transformations that my clients have had the opportunity to undergo. Specifically, I met with a client yesterday who 3 months ago was in grave danger of going to prison if he couldn't turn things around. His drug court gave him the opportunity instead to go to inpatient treatment, which he did for a month. Then he did a transitional program. At the time he was facing prison, he was also facing losing his children, having his rights terminated. He was homeless. He was unemployed, basically living out of a bag and going to shelter every night.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I met him at his apartment, which is in a supportive, stable, sober living environment. He is beginning overnight visitation with his children. He has 2 jobs now. He's seeing a therapist. He's attending NA meetings. In a matter of 3 months, thanks to the grace of drug court, everything has changed for this person, and not just this person, but his community, who he's now actually contributing to, and his children, who are now going to get to have their father mm-hmm. in their life.
Would you say that example there, that very positive example, is typical, or is it more the exception?
Well, he's certainly a superstar. I mean, I think he's gone above and beyond. And I have clients on the spectrum. I have folks who are still in danger of losing their children despite their involvement in these programs. And I have folks who've been able to get their children back very successfully and are living happy, healthy, productive lives. So, of course, there's a spectrum. But I think it's about the kind of community we want to create and the kind of opportunities we want to give people to become who they have the potential to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what these courts do, that just a normal criminal court or a normal juvenile court really doesn't give folks a true opportunity to do.
Mm-hmm. Many of the clients that you've worked with without a drug court being present would have been bound for jail or prison again?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the reason I actually became interested in drug court was because I had a client who was facing a Class C felony for possessing methamphetamine precursors with an intent to produce methamphetamine. This was probably back in 2010. We had a plea agreement in place with the state that he was going to go on probation, but in between his plea hearing and his sentencing hearing, he relapsed. And at the sentencing hearing, the judge said, I don't trust that you're going to do what you're supposed to do on probation. I'm sending you to prison. And I remember feeling so strongly, this man is not a criminal. He's an addict. And feeling so helpless because there was no place for him to really get the assistance he needed at that time. He called me probably a year ago. He had just been paroled after spending 4 years in prison. And he said, Rachel, I just relapsed. I'm going back to prison again. And it just sort of reinvigorated that same feeling. This is an addict. This is not a criminal. And yet he's spending years of his life in prison, not getting the treatment he needs to become the person that he has the potential to become. I just think that's such an important example of what could have been different if maybe he had had the opportunity to participate in a drug court program.
Rachel, I don't know how much you have a handle on the bigger picture when it comes to funding these courts, but let me ask you, do you see them as a wise investment? I mean, when we talk about the legislature putting money forward for these, does this, if we take the human side apart, which we've heard about, but we want to separate that from it right now, from the debate, in terms of economics, does it make sense as an investment to fund these drug courts?
Absolutely. So with regard to the client I was just speaking about, I estimate he spent 4 years in prison. In Iowa in 2014, the average cost to incarcerate a person, each person, $33,000 a year. This guy spent 4 years in prison, so that's roughly, you know, $150,000, somewhere in there. He could have funded my family treatment court that I participate in that has 10 participants and two staff people for 2 to 3 years, just based on what it costs to incarcerate this man alone. Mm-hmm. So looking at that and looking at the benefits I've seen people achieve in family treatment court, I think it makes absolute financial sense to invest in these courts.
Mm-hmm. With that as an explanation, why do you believe there's a constant issue of funding?
I think folks are a little bit short-sighted when it comes to looking at the long-term potential benefits of these courts. So yes, they are labor-intensive, they are time-intensive, and they cost money up front. And I think folks see that dollar figure and they don't want to invest. I think folks also have a hard time as seeing people involved in the criminal justice system or people who are suffering from substance abuse issues as human. So it's hard to invest in someone who you don't perceive to be the same as yourself. I think part of the benefit of these courts is that they allow prosecutors and judges and probation officers and social workers to begin to see drug addicts and people who have engaged in criminal behavior as actual humans who can be treated with kindness and compassion and actually get to the heart of their addiction so they can be productive people.
Okay. Rachel Antonuccio, attorney in the Juvenile Division of the Iowa City Public Defender's Office. Thank you for your view and your experiences, sharing your experiences working with drug courts.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week to get to some news, small news bits that we didn't get to otherwise during the week in our talk shows. The Iowa State Fair kicks off next week, August 13th through the 23rd. Joining us for a few minutes, a man who has been covering the State Fair for most of the 20-plus years he's been working at the Des Moines Register, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Register. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Ben. Hey, good to talk to you.
You know, I want to start off. I know you've posted already about this. You'll have continuing updates throughout the fair days. But as with many people, I am overwhelmed when I go to the Iowa State Fair. So many things to do, see. How in the world do you approach covering a state fair?
Well, yeah, it's true. It is overwhelming. I always like to say that instead of going roaming around Iowa, I can just sit in one place and let Iowa come to me. But you're right. It's just, it's almost a million people. It becomes a little bit overwhelming. So it's like anything. There are some things you cannot ignore. Like, for instance, this year we know the fair is going to be inundated with politicians, presidential candidates, They're going to be speechifying at the Register soapbox. So that's something that's going to be a part of the fabric of the fair. And you know somebody's going to say something, or you know, somebody will be eating a corn dog, or the politicians will be grilling at the pork tent. That's just something we have to cover in a lot of them in different ways, you know, both what they say policy-wise and kind of what quirky things might happen. But then every year is a different wrinkle. There's always some new character at the fair. There might be somebody in the fiddle contest, say, that's just an amazing story. There might be some 4-H-er exhibiting, you know, his or her livestock that has just an incredible kind of story behind that. So you never kind of know what little human, you know, story is going to kind of bubble up at the fair.
Mm-hmm. New foods, of course, the Iowa State Fair, known for foods, in particular foods on a stick. Do you have any new lines on the food?
Well, yeah, we have. In fact, you know, themorningregister.com, we have both. We have a list of all 75 foods on the stick at the Iowa State Fair. Plus, the easiest way to get it is actually have this Fair Food Finder app you can download for your smartphone. And, so the fair this year, they always, you know, not just the Iowa State Fair, but the state fair culture in general, they always now, it's almost this arms race of new foods. And so at the Iowa State Fair, you know, they have everything from corn in a cup to deep fried cherry pie, which kind of intrigues me. a donut sundae, peanut butter and jelly on a stick, which I don't know how far the stick thing can go. Anyway, so the ultimate bacon explosion. Of course, there has to be bacon involved because this is Iowa. There's a guy that is even, he built his own coolers, and this is under the new foods category, I guess, generally. 27 degree super chill beer. So anyway, it's the fair.
Okay. Well, on the other end of things, I'm sorry to make this pun, but there's the celebrity cow chip toss. Have you done this?
Yeah, that, you know, it was this, when I started working at the Register, this was, the KRMT, radio station KRMT started this ages ago. And so some of my, you know, journalist colleagues indoctrinated me in going out on the Wednesday of the fair to participate in the celebrity couch toss. So it's one of those quirky annual traditions that I've done year after year. And I've lost year after year.
What have you learned? Is it really the secret in the selection of the chip or the technique you use to toss it?
Yeah, I've written about this before. A lot of my colleagues, both in TV and other print media or you know, radio, whatever, have talked about this before. Some people do say the secret is to have a chip with a grip, as they say.
A chip with a grip.
And, yeah, so you stand on the top of Pioneer Hill in front of Pioneer Hall there, and everybody throws downhill, and they have the, you know, almost kind of like a football field or something. They have the you know, feet marked down on the hill, and then you toss it and try to throw the farthest without, you know, veering off into the crowd, slicing off into the crowd. So it's a goofy contest, but it's a lot of fun. It's kind of one of those media camaraderie sort of moments of the year.
Mm-hmm. There's a tradition at the Iowa State Fair that I believe you started, the Oh Say Can You Sing contest.
Yeah, so it's so every day you're at the fair at 10 a.m. you'll hear a different Iowan singing the national anthem, and they stand on top of the administration building and they belt it out, and that's also broadcast around the fairgrounds. So the notion of having people, you know, obviously sing the anthem wasn't a new thing. You know, ballparks do this. The Iowa Cubs, for instance, audition people at the start of the season to sing the anthem throughout their, you know, their home games during their season. But when I was working as a digital editor at the Register several years back, we started this. So we had people send in videos of themselves singing, and then people voted on it. And then they're able to sing, the winners sing at one day at the fair throughout the 11-day run of the fair. And so this has continued. So Oh Say Can You Sing is a part of the fair, and maybe that'll be my lasting legacy when everything is said and done.
Uh-huh. Has your voice been ever featured in the contest?
I've spared Iowa from that. No, that's okay.
Okay. Before we go, I wonder, with all the fair days that you have covered in your 20-plus year career at the Register, ever get tired of the fair? Fair fatigue?
Yeah, you know, people, yeah. I mean, I just had a colleague ask me that the other day, probably wondering why I'm putting myself through this. You know, yes and no, of course, yeah. Some days I leave there and I walk out in the parking lot and I can't find my car and I'm like, why am I doing this? But in reality, if you love Iowa, the people, the stories, both kind of the serious and the quirkiness of it all, I mean, the fair is the biggest event. As you know, I put this list together a couple weeks ago called, 25 Reasons I Love the State Fair, and it's a mix of both serious and sappy. And, one of the things I said was, hey, what other event in Iowa can credibly combine quilting and Sir Mix-a-Lot? You know, this is the only event of its scope and size and breadth, really, in Iowa that we have. It's really seriously of the people. But then also seriously, I said a couple of the most touching things I've ever seen at the fair. One, just last year I saw, new citizens taking, the oath of citizenship at the state fair. And that was a special moment at one of the stages. And then every year they also recognize the Century Farms and the Heritage Farms, people that have had farms in their families for 100 or 150 years. So, this is a place where Iowa's past and the future are really celebrated in a special way. So I appreciate that about it.
Okay. August 13th through the 23rd, next week it kicks off the annual Iowa State Fair. Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, will be posting updates throughout the fair. Kyle Munson, always a joy to speak with you. We'll look forward to those updates. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise, Ben. See you out there.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and finally on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, the Princeton Review released its annual list of top party schools. 2 years ago, the University of Iowa earned the very top spot on the list, but was bumped to number two last year. This year, the University of Iowa remains the number two party school, with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign taking the top spot. A year ago, in September of 2014, River to River producer Emily Woodbury went out on a Saturday night in Iowa City around 9 p.m. to find out how people were spending their night downtown and if they were drinking, how much they consumed. Here's a random survey of the people she spoke with.
Are you guys drinking tonight?
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
What are you guys having?
A little bit of everything.
Well, since it's game day, we're drinking a bunch of beer earlier, but most of the time I drink whiskey and she drinks rum. Like, we'll split like a fifth and then we'll go to the bars.
Yeah.
I black out almost every single time I drink.
I had some Busch Light.
I had Smirnoff and Red Bull, actually.
Some whiskey and Cokes.
How long have you guys been in Iowa City and what do you think of Iowa City's drinking culture?
Well, I go to school here and I've been here about 4 years. And it gets pretty crazy sometimes.
It's pretty good. I'm not going to lie, when I'm looking for something to do, I'm always looking for Iowa City to pull through for me, so it's pretty good.
It's kind of like the only thing to do here.
Oh, I want to go that far. I think if you want to do something else, like there's a lot of clubs and stuff, but like, I mean, like, I think it's like normal for a college kid to just like drink on the weekends.
I've been here for the day, and every time I come to Iowa City, I drink more than I drink anywhere else. Because of the tailgating and because of the culture here, like, it's just such a fun college city and different bars. It's unique and it's just a really good time.
Everyone comes to Iowa shitty to get shitty.
I've been here for like 6 hours and I've been drinking the whole time, so I enjoy it. I drink with everybody. I drink with this girl, I drink with that guy. Do it all. So it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
I think the issue too is that our bar scene is so concentrated that there just tends to be a ton of people in one area. You know, that doesn't help the rep that our school gets. So.
River to River producer Emily Woodbury in downtown Iowa City on a Saturday night last year. The University of Iowa was again ranked the number two party school in the latest Princeton Review annual list, which ranks colleges and universities in 62 categories based on a survey of some 136,000 students at 380 schools. The University of Iowa in recent years has launched programs and initiatives aimed at decreasing high-risk and underage drinking on and around campus. Here's some of my conversation with University of Iowa Vice President for Student Life, Tom Rocklin, from last year, where he talked about a survey showing a decrease in self-reported binge drinking by 30,000 University of Iowa students.
So this is a sample of those 30,000 students, and what we found is, you know, on our key indicators, things like have you engaged in what we would call binge drinking in the last 2 weeks? We see a decline from 70% down to 54.1%. All our other indicators are showing us the same thing.
This is self-reporting when you reach out to students and they do something online or otherwise?
It is. It's a paper survey that they take. And, you know, it's possible that they're telling us something other than the truth. But since we're looking at change over time, I don't think the way that they're telling us something over the truth is other than the truth has changed.
2009, 70% reporting binge drinking down to 54%. It's an improvement. Still, 54% of the student body reporting binge drinking.
Absolutely. It's a big concern for us. We've made a lot of progress. And at the same time, we have a whole lot of work left to do.
Mm-hmm. And 2009 is an important year because when we look at 2009, that was prior to the introduction of an important ordinance in Iowa City. Tell us about that.
Sure. People might not understand because it is a little bit unusual that prior to 2009, people could be in bars below the drinking age. And, of course, they weren't supposed to drink while they were in the bars, but they did. And in 2009, the community decided that wasn't what we wanted to be, and passed an ordinance that changed that. And that ordinance has now survived two referendum challenges over the last 5 years. So I think the community has spoken about what they want to see in terms of alcohol safety.
Tom Rockland, Vice President for Student Life at the University of Iowa, recorded last year. That's all for our program this week. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.